Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
All right, are we ready? Okay. All the dials are set. The levels are checked. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. And, of course, don't forget to go to my landing page. Go to the entertainment section. Look up Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and you will find 109 episodes up there. You know why? Because this is episode 110. I don't think anybody thought we'd get to 10. And we've got 110. So we'll see just how far this little podcasting world could go. But thank you so much for joining us. In fact, last week we did not have a podcast. There have been some technical issues as WGN Radio moved to a new location. And so while I missed speaking with you, at the same time, I do appreciate the kind emails from many people saying, Elton, Jim, where's the new podcast? Where's the new podcast? So someone's listening. So thank you very much, as we will do our best to provide you with high-quality podcasting pleasure and entertainment on a regular basis. So thank you for that. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things today. First of all, I have to say that, you know, it sounds very cliched, and I don't want to get all into this, you know, new agey kind of stuff, but there are times when things happen in your life where you do just say, well, that was cool. And you say, well, how do I make this happen, kind of a thing, you know? And that happened to me recently in that I was, you know, hoping to get a long-time goal of mine, a very long-time goal, and like a 30-year goal. And, you know, so often in our lives, we have these dreams and, you know, we hope that they come true and we work toward them. And then as time goes on, we may get distracted or we may get discouraged and we just may give them up. And that happens with everybody. And it certainly happened with me, but I do try not to forget them, and I always try to keep plugging away. Like I've always said in my life, I feel like I'm the prince of perseverance, of just keep going, of keep plugging away. I certainly have had goals and dreams, and I've been lucky enough to achieve many of them, most of them, in fact. But at the same time, I have to tell you, they all haven't happened in close clusters. They have taken quite a long time. And some have come quicker than others, but I'm happy to say that many of them have come true. And I'm also excited to say that many of them, when they have come true, they have been all that I had hoped they would have been to some extent, right? Not perfect, but, you know, you have these dreams and what you imagine they would be like, and you hope that if they do come to a reality, that they meet up to your expectation. But you first have to get that those goals and those dreams, and you do have to set out on a course to make them happen. So oftentimes, I think we have a dream in our minds, and we say, "Wouldn't that be great if that happened?" But what are we doing to really make them happen? And I think that really is even kind of a test to see what is really one of a true dream or a true goal, and one that just might be some fleeting fancy in your mind. Because I think the ones that you really care about, the ones that really mean something to you, you do pursue them. At least I hope you do. I do. And there are some ideas that you say, "Wouldn't that be cool?" And you know, you maybe not pursue them as much just because maybe they are pie in the sky. And there are some, yes, there are some pie in the sky dreams and goals. There's no doubt about that. But there are some that may seem out of reach that if you do put your time and your effort into them, you can make them come true. You know, a couple of years ago, there was a horrible movie. It flopped at the box office, if you recall, called The Bucket List. It starred Jack Nicholson. And while the movie did not do well, the term bucket list and the idea of the movie, it wasn't a very good script, but but the basic idea of this bucket list, if you remember the story, or if you never saw the movie, which you may probably haven't, but you certainly have heard the term that derived from it, was the bucket list. And the idea was Jack Nicholson's character was dying, and before he died, he wanted to do X amount of things. He'd realized that he hadn't done or experienced or achieved some of the things that he always wanted to. And so he went out on this quest, and he made this bucket list, put everything in a bucket. So as I said, the movie was not a very big hit at all, but the concept of the bucket list has certainly lived on. It's become a part of our pop culture now, and we constantly hear people using the term bucket list. It's either going to be on your bucket list or it is on your bucket list, depending on your age. I would say if you're younger, you put it, you know, you put your bucket list, you build your bucket list when you're younger. And then as you get older, you start to act on your bucket list because you realize that, you know, your time is might not have as much time as you initially had. So the bucket list actually can live on in your life for a while. Filling that bucket with ideas, and then as you continue to go through life, you start to go into that bucket and pull those out. At least that's the way I look at it. And if I've always, as I've always said too, if you've listened to me with any regularity, when a new year approaches and we get a new year, the way I look at a new year is basically a blank page of our lives. You know, we are writing our own life story. You remember that great song by Gladys Knight? If anyone should ever write my life story. Well, we're writing our life story every day we live, whether we know it or not. And so I always look at a new year as a new blank page. And it's my responsibility to fill that blank space, that blank page. So on January 1st of every new year, it's empty. And then on December 31st, to go back and say, what did I do with those 365 days? Did I fill those up as well as I should have? Because you realize that all those blank pages in that your book of life, you may look very thick, but you realize how fast those pages turn. So fill up those pages, gang. That's what I try to do, and that's what I think the bucket list is certainly part of that. That kind of whole concept of you know, and once again, if you know me, you know that I love lists. Oh, I love to make lists. I've got a list right in front of me right here. Record podcast for today. Oh, I love making lists. I make a list every beginning of the week, and I continue to modify it. And as I said many times, there is nothing better than to cross off one of the items on your list when you have accomplished it. Even on a daily basis, it feels really good to have put a list down of everything you want to get done that day, and then you do it, and you are reminded of it, and that list is sitting there. And sometimes at the end of the day, you didn't get to something, and you go, damn, all right, put that down into the next day, but make sure it gets done. So as I said, the bucket list, I think, is actually a very, it may sound kind of trite, and it may have come from a pretty bad movie, but it's, I think it's a valid idea. And what I've done in a bucket list kind of way is I have not only created some things I'd like to do, but from a travel standpoint especially, I really enjoy traveling, and there are certain places and certain sites in this country as well as throughout the world that I would love to see. And so once again, rather than just have those floating around where they could easily be forgotten, I have written those down. I have a file on my computer, and I am slowly but surely, and in some cases not slowly, I am making a concerted effort now to get those done. Some of those things you say, God, I'd love to do this. I'd love, like for instance, I would love and always have wanted to visit the pyramids. I don't know why, but there's just something about that. Obviously, they're majestic, they're historic, so it's not hard to figure out why I'd want to see them, but I'm not a huge fan of Egyptian art or Egyptian history per se, but there's been always a draw to see those pyramids, and I haven't gone there yet. And geez, over the last 20 years it hasn't really always been very safe to go to the areas where the pyramids are, but I'm going to make a concerted effort to get to those pyramids soon because I really want to see those. And that's the point. So it's on that list. And as well as other things. And now that I think about it, as I sort of tick those off, I will mention some of those to you on an ongoing basis here. Like, oh, just so you know, another place I wanted to always visit, I did. And here it is. So that'd be kind of fun. In the segment that we would call Toronto's Travels, but getting back to my original idea, so here's one that I thought I would share with you because it really has really if I look back at 2018 and here it is only the half part of the year for me, it's already been a memorable year because I have done something that I have always wanted to do, always wanted to get the opportunity to do, and had a vision of what it would be like. And I'm happy to say that not only did this goal or this dream live up to it, but it actually may have surpassed it, which is really cool, which is why I wanted to share this with you. So let's go back in the time machine to 1986, and a young Elton Jim is only about 21, 22 years old at the time. And as you can obviously tell, I've always been interested in entertainment. I'm a huge music fan, huge movie fan, huge television fan, huge theater fan. I enjoy the arts of all kind and always have. I think I got that from my mom, who was a big fan. In fact, I had to laugh. You know, when I was a little kid, my bedroom, when I found Elton John's music and became a huge fan, in my bedroom at home when I grew up, in first, like most little kids, especially boys of that era, in the early mid-70s, growing up, I had, pictures of sports heroes. I had Ron Santo, Dick Butkus, Bobby Hull, and Tony Esposito. Those were my big major sports fans, heroes. And I had posters and I had, Cub memorabilia in my room. I was a Cub fan, obviously still am, born on the northwest side of Chicago. But it was mostly, it was very much a little boy's room filled with sports and things like that. And then I found Elton's music in like 1973 when I was 9 years old. And suddenly I bought, I started to buy posters and the albums. And suddenly the room went from a sports oriented room into into an Elton room. And then it was completely dominated with posters on the ceilings and every wall and on mirrors and on bedboards and you name it, on curtains everywhere. I have photos of it as well. Thankfully, my mom said, you know, you better get a picture of this room because you'll never believe it. And I'm glad she told me to do that because I did take pictures at its height and I still have them and they do bring back a lot of memories. But and I remember my dad who had bought me all those sports posters and all this sports stuff. And then all of a sudden he's seeing pictures of Elton John wearing bird outfits and feathers and wild glasses. And I think he looked at me like, okay, where did this come from? But he came to accept it. My mom certainly did. But my point is, so I was way into this stuff. I collected photos. I made a collage, an Elton John collage. I went through magazines and cut out all these pictures and made a huge collage that I hung in my room. And as I said, I had a little scrapbook with all the different pictures and different things of my Elton travels and still, in many cases, still do. And I had to let my mom always encourage that. And so here I am today, you know, still doing that. I have a room still somewhat dedicated to Elton and have, you know, 10 or 12 bins of Elton John memorabilia and their stuff around the house, not just in that one room. And obviously, if you listen to my podcast and hear me on the radio, I've been to 177 Elton John concerts. So I think I've earned the nickname Elton Jim. But anyway, when my mom passed away, which is, wow, now going on, it'll be 12 years this year, I was going through a lot of her belongings, and I found, couldn't believe this, I found several of these scrapbooks with autographed pictures and fan letters that she wrote and letters that she got back from some of these people, these celebrities that she liked. She was, you know, she was older, you know, she was around in the big band era in the, you know, 30s and 40s and 50s. And so she had all these pictures of these musicians and these band leaders and things like that. And I was, oh my gosh, without even knowing it, you talk about genetics. There it was. No wonder why she was always supportive of that. Because she did it, not just when she was a little kid too, you know, into her adult life. And I was like, she never told me that. As I said, she never discouraged me, but she did the same thing. And when I saw this, I almost fell over. I was like, Mom, why didn't you ever tell me you had these scrapbooks and you did the same thing? And that's probably one reason why she took me to that first Elton John concert in 1976. Because she got it. She understood it. And I still have her scrapbook of all those things. It's just a reminder of really the connection and the kindred spirits that we were, despite obviously being, mother and son. But just as we grew up, you know, as we both developed as people, innately, the same interest and the same kind of passion toward those. And as I said, my mom never said, you know, put these in a scrapbook or, you know, my passion for the things I'm into always seemed natural to me. But now I wonder somehow, some way, genetically or through osmosis, I don't know. I did pick that up from her because my gosh, to see that scrapbook very similar to the same kinds of things that I do and have done in terms of my fandom, if you will, with people like Elton John and Bruce Springsteen. As I said, just overall with my interest in the arts and in entertainment. I have posters and the things I've seen and the things I've done. There's got to be something to this genetics thing, folks. But anyway, so When I'm going through all this and thinking about stuff, as I said, as a young person, I was way into movies. And then thankfully, when the video cassettes came out, VHS first came out, suddenly we had access to these movies anytime we wanted. Before, and people don't remember, especially younger people, think that there was always this complete access to whatever you wanted. No, folks, access to things was very limited for a long time. You didn't see a classic movie like, you know, Casablanca or whatever it might be, unless, you know, it was on the Late, Late, Late Show on television. Movie houses didn't play old films anymore. If it wasn't on TV, you didn't see it. And suddenly, when VHS movies came out and you could rent them, that's where I got my education, was really in the early to mid-80s when VHS became popular. I was at the video store every 2 days renting 5 movies at a time and just soaking this stuff up, because there was all these movies that I'd always heard about but never had seen because they were never on television as often. And I really, they talk about, you know, putting in your 10,000 hours to be good at something. That's when I put my 10,000 hours in, when VHS came out and I was renting movies like a madman. At Rolling Stone Records on the Northwest Side here in Chicago, that's where they were one of the first ones to have a very in-depth collection. And then all of a sudden, the mom and pop video stores started to show up on throughout the streets of Chicago and the suburbs. And then, of course, Blockbuster came. But in the early days, I went to good old Rolling Stone Records. I bought my CDs and my vinyl, and then I rented some great old movies. And that's where I got my education in terms of movies and entertainment. And one of the things that I naturally went to was the theater. My mom and dad used to take me as a young kid to a lot of the dinner theater shows. In fact, there was in Arlington Heights, right next to Arlington Park Racetrack, there was the Arlington Park Hilton. And they had a dinner theater in the hotel. And many, at that time, it was called Dinner Theater. It was a small theater. It was probably 300 people, if that. And it was in the round, usually. So the seats were around the stage in the middle. And what happened there, was actually a circuit where a lot of either former television stars or even former movie stars who had name recognition, and they would be able to fill up a 300 or 400 seat theater just by their appearing, and they would appear in different plays. And it was called dinner theater. And the whole idea was you would go to that venue, and you would have a dinner beforehand, and then you'd go to the play, which is very similar to here in the Chicago area, the Drury Lane, which is still around, especially in Oak Brook. That's what you do. You go to dinner, and then you go to the theater. And but this one at Arlington Park was very cool because, as I said, it was in the round. And so my mom and dad would take me on a Sunday afternoon, and I saw, you know, some of the bigger stars of the day. I remember seeing George Hamilton. I remember seeing who else? I remember seeing Mickey Rooney. I remember seeing Bob Crane. Remember Bob Crane from Hogan's Heroes? I remember seeing quite a few of the big name stars of the day. So I was exposed to that, and always would go to that as a young kid. And then on my own, I continued to go to see live performances. Used to go to the Mill Run Theater here in Chicago, or in Niles, and saw some great people too. Once again, mom and dad would take me there. I saw Freddie Prinze and Red Fox. My dad really loved comedians, and so we would go to a lot of those. Saw George Carlin. Saw many of the stars of the day. I think we even saw Don Rickles there one time. But my point is, so I got into the theater as well as TV and movies, and so I was always read about this stuff. And so I read about, in the mid-80s, I read about this play that was written by a Chicagoan called David Mamet, a young, new, aspiring, wunderkind writer, David Mamet. and he wrote this play called Glengarry Glen Ross, and it was about the cutthroat world of selling real estate, like land real estate, not so much like homes, not a real estate agent that would go and show you a home, more like kind of the slimy people that would try to sell you some swampland in Florida, literally. And I guess he worked in that kind of an office when he was a younger guy, and that's where he saw this going on, and that's where he got the inspiration to write this play called Glengarry Glen Ross, which refers to different names of lands. You know, there would be, oh, here's the, remember, you know, Galena was, you know, there was a big thing, I remember, in the 70s when they were, you know, selling land in Galena. And it was the same kind of thing. They would give, you know, they give these different lands, these different areas, these exciting names. So there was the Glen, in this play, for instance, there's the Glengarry Farms or the Glengarry Highlands or the Ross or the Rio Rancho and things like that. The Glen Ross Farms, you know. So that's where the name comes from. But so I was always a big fan of the TV show Columbo. Still am. I still watch it on the Hallmark Murder and Mystery channel. It's on every day at 7 o'clock in the morning. I tape them. It's also at 5 in the morning on the weekends, and I sometimes wake up on a Saturday morning and Sunday morning to watch them. I love Columbo. Seen him a million times, still can't get enough of him. And so I was intrigued because not only was Glengarry Glen Ross coming back to Chicago, it had won Joe Mantegna, local actor from Chicago who wrote Bleacher Bums, who then went on to a star in this play, Glengarry Glen Ross, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1984 for David Mamet, and then went on to go to Broadway. And this relatively unknown actor, Joe Mantegna, winds up winning the Tony Award for Glengarry Glen Ross. So, of course, in the Chicago area, in the theater world, it was big stuff. And to bring this show to the masses, and not just in Broadway in New York, they did a touring production of it. And Joe Mantegna starred in that as well, which was a great opportunity for him to bring his Tony Award-winning performance now to the rest of the country. And what they do a lot of times in touring companies is they will change the original cast from the Broadway cast, but they do try to get another, you know, some high-profile people. Well, Peter Falk wound up being a part of the cast of this Glengarry Glen Ross. Now, you may have heard in more recent times of the film version that came out in the 90s, which is a classic movie. If you have not seen the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, there's one you have to see, folks. When that movie was first made in the 1990s, it was filled with a lot of well-known actors. But since that movie was made, more than 25 years ago, I would say, at this point, four of the people in that movie have won Academy Awards, and I think the other two have been nominated for Academy Awards. So the entire cast is either an Academy Award winner or Academy Award nominee. And at the time, none of them, I think Jack Lemmon was the only person who had won an Academy Award up to that point. So it's quite a cast. And in the movie version, there's Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alan Arkin, Kevin Spacey, Alec Baldwin, Ed Harris, and Jonathan Pryce. That's not bad. And as I said, the Oscar winners now are Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alan Arkin, and who else? And Kevin Spacey. Those four have won Academy Awards. Ed Harris has been nominated for an Academy Award. Alec Baldwin has been nominated for an Academy Award. Jonathan Pryce won the Tony Award. He was in Miss Saigon. So everybody in that movie winds up being an award-winning actor and a very prominent actor. And it's a great version. And Mamet rewrote the screenplay and added something. In fact, there's the famous scene that we know with Alec Baldwin that is not in the play, but is in the actual, but is in the movie, where he says, you know, coffee is for closers. It's actually become a little pop culture phrase now. That's not in the play, though, but it is in the film version. But definitely go see or rent or stream, whatever you do, Glengarry Glen Ross. You have to see it. So there is this play version, which is based on. And so they did this touring company, and so I went to see it because I wanted to see this play. I'd read so much about it, and I was a huge fan of Peter Falk. I got to see Columbo in person. How cool is that? So I go to see this, and I was blown away by the play, and I was really transfixed and just really moved and really connected with the character, the lead character that was played by Joe Mantegna. And of course, we know Joe Mantegna. As I said, he went on to you know, he wrote Bleacher Bums, which is about the Cubs and the Bleachers, which was a big hit and still is played around town and around the country. And now he is on Criminal Minds. He's been on that show for about 10 or 15 years at least. And he's worked, he's been in Woody Allen movies. He was in Godfather Part 3. So, I mean, you know, he certainly has a good resume here. But Glengarry Glen Ross is what really, you know, changed his professional life, his professional career. And so I saw him in this play just a, you know, a couple of years after he had done it on Broadway. So he was still relatively unknown. He was obviously, he won the Tony, but he was not yet a household name. And I was just transfixed by his performance and in this play, and just as a character. And I at that time, at 21 or 22 years old, I was not even thinking of ever doing acting of any kind at the time. I was still very, and still am, focused on radio. That was my first love, and always will be, and still is. But I couldn't help but be, you know, just mesmerized by this play. I just loved the play. It was such a Chicago play, and the David Mamet's writing, which is very unique in its cadence and in its word choice, and it's known for its, as I call it, its profane poetry. He uses the F word and every other profane word you can think of, but it's written in such an elegant way, if that's possible. And there's other David Mamet movies that you should see if you haven't seen them. One called House of Games, another one called Things Change, another one called the Spanish Prisoner, another one called State and Main. If you watch those movies, as well as Glengarry Glen Ross, you'll get a very good idea of the kind of characters and the kind of world that that David Mamet has created through his writing. And, of course, another play that he's written is called American Buffalo, which is a very well-known play. And then he wrote the play of which the movie About Last Night, which came out in the 80s with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore, was based on, called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And that became About Last Night. So you may be a David Mamet fan and you don't even know it. But I became a David Mamet fan in 1986 when I saw this production of Glengarry Glen Ross. And so it was always in the back of my mind. I've seen the play performed several times throughout the years because it's always been a favorite of mine. I've seen it a few times here in Chicago. I saw it at the Steppenwolf Theater, and a couple of years ago, my wife and I, about 5 or 6 years ago, we went to see a Broadway revival of it with Al Pacino, who did not play his original role now of Ricky Roma, which is also the Joe Mantegna role. But he played another role. He played the Jack Lemmon role in the movie, if you've seen the movie, of Shelley the Machine Levine, because now he's older. He couldn't really play the younger role anymore. But it was great to see Al Pacino in that play in any way and see him on stage as well. And Bobby Cannavale, who was in Boardwalk Empire, played the role of Ricky Roma now. So I've seen the play at least 4 or 5 times. And when I started to do acting about 15 years ago, that was always a dream role of mine. I was like, okay, now that I started doing this, I would love to be in Glengarry Glen Ross. It was just always one of these, I want to be in that. So the seed was actually, you know, planted, you know, in 1986, which is now, what, 32 years ago? And it's slowly and quietly, you know, been nurtured and been watered and grew. But, you know, the odds of it happening were still, you know, who knows. And then as time went on, I started acting. But that was, you know, many years later. You figure, say, if I was 22, I didn't start doing any acting. I never went on, an audition until 2003. So it was a while. I always felt that I had the acting ability and the acting bug, and I had been a movie reviewer, not only a fan, but I had become a movie reviewer and a theater reviewer for newspapers. And so I certainly was around actors, and I was studying actors and watching how they worked and watching their performances and critiquing their performances and being blown away by some and being completely disappointed or disconnected by others. So I felt that while I'd never studied acting professionally, I felt that I certainly got my own sort of acting classes by being such a fan and then being a critic and watching people on stage and in movies and how they were acting and deciding for myself what I felt was good and what wasn't, and seeing some of the classic actors of all time, whether it was Marlon Brando, you know, in The Godfather, or in, you know, On the Waterfront, or if it was going to plays and seeing some of the greatest actors of all time on stage live. So that was kind of where I got my my acting class, by being taught by some of the masters, just by experiencing them doing their craft. So this thing, you know, in the back of my mind, once I started to act, I said, wow, it would be kind of neat to someday do Glengarry Glen Ross. Wouldn't that be cool? And I have auditioned for a couple of productions over the last several years, and unfortunately I didn't get them, and I was very disappointed, and that's a part of the acting world, and it's a part of the world if you get into the arts. You know, unfortunately, rejection is something that you have to deal with on a daily basis. It's not fun, and I don't think you ever really can fully accept it, but you do gain a thicker skin, for sure. And like I said many times, I've got the skin of a shark at this point. But I had auditioned for a few times for Glengarry Glen Ross productions, did not get them, and the play is not done all that often. And so, as I said before, you talk about bucket lists and sort of looking at things and sort of with time running out, you say, geez, am I ever going to be able to achieve this? And so Glengarry Glen Ross was one of those things that I felt that there was a timer running, because to play this the role I wanted to play, this role of Ricky Roma in Glengarry Glen Ross, which was defined and first introduced by Joe Mantegna right here in Chicago at the Goodman Theater, I'm like, you know, there's going to come a point here where I won't be age appropriate. I've got to get this role soon, in the back of my mind. But once again, you know, it really wasn't up to me. I'm hoping that someday there will be a production and that I will audition for it and that I will get the role. Those are quite big obstacles to have to overcome, because I certainly had tried in the past and wasn't able to do those. And as I said, as time went on, it's like, oh, you know, this has been in the buckets for a long time. I really want this one to happen. So much to my excitement, about a year ago, as I was scanning around and looking at different theater groups in the Chicago area, I found that there was a group in the suburbs of Chicago in Elmhurst called the Green Man Group, and they were going to do a production of Glengarry Glen Ross in June of 2018. Now, once again, I'm seeing this in October, or maybe even in the summer of 2017. But now I'm like, woof, ah. I am very excited about this. And yes, this is not a done deal by any means, but at least somebody's doing the play. There's a chance for this bucket list item to finally get achieved, even if the odds are great. And once again, if you're an actor and you're a male actor, you want to do David Mamet. It's challenging. As I said before, his writing and the word choice and the rhythms and the cadence, it is not easy. you have to really grapple and wrestle with it to do it justice. But when you do, you feel great about it because it is just a very unique style of writing. So there's no guarantees that A, that I could do it. B, you know, most likely a lot of people are going to audition for this show because it's a show that, you know, is very attractive for actors. And so, you know, once again, no done deal here. Thankfully, it's being produced. Thankfully, there will be auditions. But and I've done it in the past where I had auditioned and didn't get it. So no guarantees, but at least it was out there. At least the possibility was out there. And that's what I said about at the beginning of our little discussion here today, is not letting go of those dreams, not forgetting them, and doing what you can to make those things happen. And even if they may seem, you know, very far-fetched, or, you know, just keeping them alive somewhere. So when an opportunity does arrive, you're ready to pounce on it. But of course, in the Elton Jim world, nothing is easy. And I'm sure in everybody's world, it's the same thing. We all just seem to get, you know, we look at ourselves, but my gosh, you look at some and people look at me and say, oh my God, you've been able to do so many cool things. Yeah. But you know, I look at other people and say, oh my God, you've been able to do so many cool things, because we all live day to day with ourselves. And we know, the trials and tribulations that we go through on a daily basis. And we know that nobody's life is perfect and everybody's life has ups and downs. And so from afar, people's other lives look very cool to us, but we don't live with them for 24 hours a day. And so, you know, we always think the grass is greener. So, yes, while I was very excited about the chance to audition for this, I still knew that, you know, the odds are maybe this was not going to happen. But at least there was a glimmer of hope. So throughout the months, I was always checking this website to see when are the auditions for this play going to happen. Usually there's about a 6-week, you know, rehearsal period for a play. And so usually before the 2 months, I would say, before the opening night of a show is when they usually have the auditions. And many times sometimes it's 6 or 8 months before, so they could lock people in. But a lot of times, for the most part, for smaller productions and smaller theaters, you want to be 2, 2.5, 3 months before a production is when the auditions are. So I was diligently checking to see when are those auditions going to be. This was one show I wanted to and almost needed to be in. And so, of course, in my world, nothing is easy. So I was doing another show, a production of Young Frankenstein, the musical. And so one day I'm browsing around and I go on the website for the Glengarry play. And there is the audition notice and the dates and the times. And I'm like, oh, thank God, finally, I get to, when is it? Let me get this down and contact them and reserve a audition time and start to prepare for this, because I've been waiting for not only a year for this production, but in an odd way, I've been waiting since 1986 to do this, whether I knew it or not back then in 1986. I believe I did want to do it. Even though I wasn't acting, there was something in me that said, boy, that would be cool to do that role. As I said, this kind of acting thing was always somewhere in me. I just never really, pardon the pun, acted upon it for a long time because I had other goals and ambitions. But so I look at the dates for the audition, and it completely conflicts with my rehearsal time for the show that I'm in, and where it's the last week of rehearsals before the show starts, which are imperative. You have to attend the last week of a rehearsals. They're called tech weeks for people in the theater world. It's called tech week. And basically, I mean, this is this whole show now. You're coming up to, you know, to opening night. So everybody's attention is focused and you're getting everything just fine-tuned in terms of the rehearsals and the play itself and your lines and where you're supposed to be, but also the costumes, and, you know, how those fit and how you work in those, and the lighting and where the lights are, to know where the lighting is and to understand where you're at on the stage. It's a very, you know, kind of, you know, it's called like Hell Week, you know. It's because it's just, you know, you're there for 6-7 hours at a time to get all this stuff down before you open in front of an audience. Even though you've been rehearsing for 4 or 5 weeks before that, now it's crunch time. And so these auditions are right in the middle of that. There is no way that I can go to those auditions because I have tech week for this play. And I am just, I can't even tell you. I mean, I am just, you know, shattered. I'm like, I've been waiting a year for this, and now this isn't going to, you know, how am I, what am I going to do? And so I decide that I will write an email to the director of this play and say, look, I know I've never worked with this group before. I'm sure they don't know who I am. But I'm hoping that you will, maybe if you can, I know you won't have to do this because you're going to have a lot of actors come out and audition for this. But I'm hoping if you can, if you would please maybe, you know, have an audition for me before, a day or two before this where I am available, because I'm not available now. And I just poured my heart out, and I said, look, I know you don't have to do this. You don't know who I am and everything, but I've been waiting for these auditions for a year. If you can find it in your time to just see me for an audition, it would be much appreciated. And as I said, if you can't, I completely understand. But at the same time, gosh, I've really wanted to audition and really want to be in this show. And I've been following this for a year now, waiting for your audition time, and you're conflicting with my other thing. And I even put in the email, which I was surprised I was this audacious. Yes. And I said, I know you don't have to do this, but I really think I'm your Ricky Roma. I put that in the email. And the director was kind enough to respond, and he said, you know, let me look at my schedule, and I will see if I can possibly do this. And to his credit, and I give him a lot of credit, the director's name is David Soria from the Green Man Troupe, and I want to say thank you, David, because to his credit, he saw me on a Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock on part of his day. He didn't have to do that. And he came and just saw me because I could not attend the other, you know, general auditions when everybody would be coming. And he's having 3 nights of them, too. So he was certainly expecting a lot of people to audition, and he was making plans for that. Usually auditions are 1 or 2 nights. He had 3 nights because he knew that potentially he could have a lot of people auditioning. And yet he even took the time out to see me. And the added bonus, which, once again, goes to show you what a nice guy he is. Not only did he take his time out to see me, but he had one of the stage managers there to see me, you know, audition, and he even brought in another actor who he knows to read the scene with me. I just assumed that I would be reading from the script and maybe he would be throwing lines at me as another character. But he actually brought another actor friend of his who took time out of his day, didn't have to do that, to read these lines with me so I really would have somebody to act with and react with. So I was very impressed at that, both of him making and accommodating my request, and then when I actually got there, to really give me a legitimate audition, not just some sort of, okay, I'm giving you 5 minutes of my time. In fact, I think I was there for almost an hour. So that was a very good experience, and I felt really good. A, I was able to audition for it, and B, I felt that I really was able to put my best foot forward because of the care that the director had done to give me a true audition and not just say, okay, I'm giving you, you know, I'm doing this a favor for you. Show me what you got. He did it the right way. And thankfully, he did. Now, the other side of the coin, of course, I'm always, as I said many times, in many ways, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And so I decided, I went on a Saturday. He's going to see people for like 4 hours on a Sunday and 4 hours on a Monday and 4 hours on a Tuesday. He's going to see so many people. By the time he makes and sits down to make his decision, he's going to forget he even saw me on Saturday by myself. He's going to be so, it's the people that you've been most likely, maybe in my mind, reacting with the most recently is where you're going to, probably say, oh, that guy really made an impression on me. Maybe one of the last people you saw. Certainly not the first person you saw by himself on a Saturday, not even there for the official auditions. So the auditions were over. It turned out that more than 50 people auditioned for this play. There's not too many parts. There's only about 5 or 6 parts, but I was only one part that I wanted, and that was this role of Ricky Roma. And I made that very clear to him on many occasions. And so a couple of days went by, and I didn't hear anything, and so I was figuring, well, another Glengarry, Glenn Ross opportunity, unfortunately, not going to come true. And so I was, I wasn't completely down or depressed or frustrated or disappointed because I didn't get the official call. But at the same time, the longer that the days go and you don't hear anything, the more likely you haven't gotten a part. And sometimes they won't even call you to tell you you didn't get it or even send you an email. You just won't hear. And you just realize, I didn't get it. And then I was at home, and I can't remember, it was on a weekend or whatever, may have been, and I was still in this play. It was opening weekend, so I was really, my concentration and focus was on this young Frankenstein play that I was in, but at the same time, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, geez, I wonder if I got this Glengarry thing. But I had other things to distract me, but of course, the Glengarry thing was always hovering over me, and sure enough, the phone rang, and I saw it was on the caller. Thank God for caller ID. You got to love caller ID sometimes, And I saw who it was from, but I once again didn't know if he was going to say, offer me the part, or say, geez, you did a great job, but unfortunately we've chosen somebody else. Usually, to avoid confrontation and to avoid that kind of awkward rejection, if a production company or a theater company does reject you, they will send you an email, which is at least it's a nice courtesy. But it's easier. I'm sure it's got to be easier to write an email to tell somebody they didn't get it than to either tell them in person or even on the phone. So when you get the email, most of the time you know you didn't get it, and when you get the phone call, you know you did. So when the phone rang and I saw who it was, I was a little high, a little excited, but at the same time, never worked with this person, so I didn't know if he was a nice enough guy to give me the audition. So maybe he was just a nice enough guy to actually call and be courageous and brave enough to tell you on the phone that sadly I chose someone else. So I didn't know what was happening. So I pick up the phone. I'm talking to him, and he said, "I would like to offer you the role of Richard Roma." Wow. I mean, I had to sit down. And I know I had a huge smile on my face, and I know that the endorphins were running through my body. It felt like I just ran a marathon and finished, and it's because that's what it felt like. It was like a life marathon of running toward this goal of being in this play and training for it. It was like a marathon in many ways, And I hit the finish line, at least part of it. Didn't do the play yet, but being offered the role, something that 32 years before I had an inkling that I may have wanted to do it, just remembering being so moved and so taken by it, in the back of my mind saying, boy, wouldn't that be cool to do that, but never thinking I ever would even do it or even have the ability to do it. I had never acted before on a stage in a play like that. I've been on stages and I've talked in front of people. That's why I got into radio. So I have no problems in being in front of people and and speaking in public and things like that. I've been doing that since grammar school, but I never, you know, acted per se in a play. And yet something told me I was going, that it was just one of those moments. And 32 years later, here I sat when I felt as if time was running out. And here was a 32-year-old dream that was coming true. And I had my wife was home, and I hung up the phone after speaking with him, and I ran upstairs and I just looked at her and I said, I got it. I'm Richard Roma. And it was such a cool feeling. And I'm sure you've had those moments in your life, whatever your dream or whatever your special moment was, whether it was a goal that you achieved or it was a special moment with a loved one or a friend, whatever it is. But you know that feeling when there's something really cool that you're experiencing in that moment and you are cognizant that this is a special moment. So many times our memories, we realize later on what a great moment that was. But there are those times when there is something that happens in that moment where you know it is special. Whether you're the day that you get married, or the day that you have a child, or your day of your first job, or whatever, or the day you hit your first home run, or the day you got your first A on a test, or whatever it may be, you know. Those moments when they happen. And this was one of those moments. And this, as I said, was one of those moments of great, not only immediate satisfaction of that, just having auditioned and just getting something in that time. But then, as I said, the 32 years before that and the years of seeing this play and seeing other people do it and auditioning for it and not getting it and always wanting to do it and hoping to do it and then finally getting it, that moment was not lost on me. It really, I had to sit down and just go, wow, how great is this? How cool is this? And I share this elongated story with you for a simple reason. And I'm not finished yet. Let me just finish by saying we did the play. We finished it. The run went extremely well. I totally was engrossed in the role. It fit like a glove to me, as I knew it always would. I was very pleased with my performance. I was surrounded by a great cast and a great director. It as I said before at the very beginning of this podcast, you hope your dreams live up to what you imagine them to be. And I have to say that this production of Glengarry Glen Ross, thanks to the cast, thanks to the crew, thanks to the director, and thanks to the audience, not only lived up to what I always dreamed it would be, but actually exceeded it. Now, what would make it better? Obviously, if I did it in front of, 5,000 people, or maybe did it on Broadway. But once again, you got to take what you can get. That's what I mean about, some dreams may be pie in the sky. That might be pie in the sky, but at least you get a dream that might be manageable. And even though it may seem pie in the sky, it is achievable. And so I have to say that, as I said, 2018 will always go down in my mind as the year I was Richard Roma. And as I said, this experience was everything I had hoped it would be. And audiences, we got standing ovations, which was completely unexpected. And after the show, people came up to me and said, oh my gosh, you were so good. And what perfect casting. So I knew, once again, when I was 22, I knew that was me. I knew that role was me. Even though I wasn't acting, there was something inside that said, I think I could be that person. I think I could do that on a stage and be that character. And circumstances, whatever you want to call it, perseverance, keeping sight of your goals, never giving them up, having that list, having that bucket list, everything I've talked about today, it really came to fruition. And as I say, I share this with you today. I do that because I hope that you have either been able to experience some of your long-held dreams. And if you haven't, I would just say to you, don't let them go. Don't let them go. If you stay with them, and you keep them present in your memory and in your life, they can't happen. And I could tell you from personal experience that we all want our dreams and goals and ambitions to happen quickly. Sometimes if they come too easy, we don't appreciate them as much. And I have to say that it took 32 years for this goal and this dream to come true. And I never knew if it would or not. And I'm almost happy now that I have achieved it, that it took so long to happen. Because maybe if it happened a long time ago, I wouldn't have appreciated it and it wouldn't have been so special to me. But now, 32 years later, I do appreciate it. And I do recognize it, and it is now going to be a lasting memory. So all I can leave with you today is, if you have that goal, whether it's something from when you were a kid, if it was something from 30 years ago, if it's something from 10 years ago, if it's something you just thought of, persevere. Don't give it up if it's that important to you. Because if you put your mind to it, it's not just going to happen. It's just not going to fall out of the. It's not going to just fall out of the sky. It does take effort. It does take patience. It does take hard work. But if it's that important to you, it's not hard work. But it's something you have to put your time into. It's not going to just fall into your hands. For this one example, I had to go out of my way to, you know, the auditions. I couldn't go to them. So this could have been, oh well, missed opportunity. But no. I went an extra mile. I took a chance, and it worked out. And so it's a special memory and a special goal on many fronts. And so all I can leave you with today is kind of, I guess, a sharing this experience with you. And if there's some kind of way that I can help inspire you or help you to keep you on your road to your goals, I hope I can do that with this story today. Because all I know is that in this crazy life of ours, as much as we don't think it, sometimes dreams do come true. So this has been Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. I'm here on business. I'm only here for fun. The only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.